case of the day, the United States versus Booz. Mr. Berman.
Good morning. I'm Morris Berman. I'm appointed to represent Daniel Booz. I did not represent Mr. Booz in the district court. Mr. Booz is a 51-year-old man who received 30-year sentences for possessing guns and using the Iron Wings Motorcycle Clubhouse up in rural Wisconsin as a place from which to distribute cocaine and methamphetamine. But the central issue here in this case is the application of the murder guideline under 2D1.1(b)(1) for the murder of Robert Melby. And subsumed within that is the burden of proof to be applied when such a drastic increase occurs as a result of that application of the murder cross-reference. And whether, whatever burden is applied, it was met here. The district court used the preponderance of the evidence standard, and we disagree with the application or the use of that burden of persuasion here. But I want to take on right from the outset the proposition that even by preponderance of the evidence, that burden was met here. And I know that the standard of review is clear error, but that is not an abject standard. It's deferential, but it's not abject. And as I reviewed the cases, and some of which are cited in the brief, in particular Carr versus Allison Gas Turbine, and Anderson versus Bessemer City, and I know Judge Coffey dissented in the Carr case. But it seemed to me that, in fact, this court, as a reviewing court, even under the clear error standard, in civil cases, has gone through the evidence in detail, reweighed the evidence, and come to its own conclusion. It is not simply a rubber stamp for a district court's conclusion. And when documents and objective evidence contradict the finding of the district court, this court has not been reluctant to reverse. And I suggest that in this case, the documents and the objective evidence absolutely cannot be squared with the conclusion of the district court by any burden of persuasion that Daniel Booz murdered Robert Melby.
Well, if you agree that Melby was cooperating with the government?
Well, it's pretty clear under the testimony of Special Agent Jerry Southworth. First of all, in 1983, he had cooperated. Later on, he had provided information about a Mr. Kane who was bringing in drugs to the Minneapolis airport. There was no indication that any report was certainly around the clubhouse about that. That was another individual who had a motive to kill Melvin.
I just want to see what, in fact, you're willing to concede here. You don't concede that he was that the evidence established that he was giving some information to the government that members of this motorcycle gang would be unhappy with.
Had they known about it, the second part of your statement, Judge Evans, I don't believe was established that he provided information. For example, that he provided information about Kane, that was established. That he provided information way back in 83 about Booth in this theft of John Deere tractor trailers, or not tractor trailers, but lawnmowers and garden equipment. That was established. It certainly wasn't established, although some witnesses had testified about letters being found in his room, that Booth knew about that. I guess that's my answer to that.
Well, I guess you agree that Melby was killed.
Melby was killed.
And he was buried.
Probably not, if not buried, disposed of.
Well, all right. What What about the recorded conversations that relate to where he was buried?
I'm not sure the recorded conversations relate to where he was buried, but I assume you're referring to the tape between Waite and Simonsmeyer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Simonsmeyer's statement, why couldn't you guys have just buried them, or buried M, or buried him? It's not, there was some dispute about that. But in any event, that was a statement of Simonsmeyer and Waite. It didn't establish that Booth was either the person who shot him or disarticulated his limbs. And in fact, as I pointed out, there is objective evidence and documents which certainly undercut that. We have Simonsmeyer's letter, no matter how many versions this was, where he said that Booth supposedly told him that he was shot in the kneecap. There is no dispute that of the recovered leg of Melby, there was no bullet wound. There is no dispute that, according to Simonsmeyer, you have Mr. Melby being shot 2 to 4 times in the basement with a large caliber gun, a .357. That, according to Simonsmeyer, there was blood all over in the basement, and that on November 15, 1990, and remember that the death took place sometime between about the 30 or 31st of October and perhaps the 6th of November, it's unclear, Dr. Rowe, the pathologist, said that the body seemed, or she didn't say it, her report or a summary of her report said the remains seemed fresh without substantial decomposition. In any event, that there was blood all over, that a search warrant searching for evidence of first-degree murder at this residence, this clubhouse, was undertaken by the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the Dunn County Sheriff's Department, and not one scintilla of forensic evidence was found. That's beyond dispute. That's objective evidence which contradicts the witness's story. When you get to the deferential standard of review, when a judge credits testimony that is not contradicted by extrinsic evidence, the finding's virtually never clear error. That's Anderson versus Bessemer City. Here it is. The judge surmised that a lot of cleaning can go on in that period of time, but there was no evidence of that. The district court judge surmised that perhaps different bags were purchased, but there's no evidence of that.
Let me ask you this. I know that there was no state prosecution that was brought here.
Correct.
But if there had been a state prosecution, first-degree murder charge, and Booth would have been acquitted, wouldn't our case law still allow that conduct to be considered relevant conduct and proven by preponderance of the evidence in the sentencing proceeding in federal court?
Acquitted conduct can be used under the Watts case. Although that was acquitted conduct can be used. I'm not accepting that the mere preponderance of the evidence standard should be used by the court in this case or in cases like this where there is such a dramatic difference in the sentencing outcome. And this court, while it has used the preponderance standard in such matters, has implicitly accepted or agreed with Kikimura that at some point there may be a requirement for a greater showing than a mere preponderance.
So your argument then is that if the sentence would have been increased, say, 2 years or something, then a preponderance of the evidence standard could be used, but there comes a point somewhere where the ratcheting up of the sentence becomes so significant that it has to be clear and convincing or preponderant or proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, that's certainly the approach taken by the Second Circuit and the Third Circuit in the cases I cited, Kikimura, Giganti, and certainly the one implicitly hinted at by the Eighth Circuit in Townley. And I wrestled with, well, where do you draw the line? But this court and courts engage in that kind of line drawing all the time, where a preponderance is not enough.
Well, Mr. Berman, we're not working off a dry record, right? This isn't a summary judgment situation where a judge read some depositions and now you're asking us to read depositions. This is indeed a case where a district judge took testimony. Is that correct?
She took testimony and received a number of written exhibits.
Right, right. And let me ask you this. Your position is it's both insufficient and contradictory? That is the body of evidence that's presented to her?
Correct.
Now, what difference would it be in a case where we had an alibi below, let's say, was presented, and there are witnesses to the contrary, and the district judge, and it's just a testimonial difference. We don't have much in the way of forensic evidence. And the district judge chose to disregard the alibi evidence and went with the other evidence. Would it be any different than the quantum difference we have here as to the contradictory evidence or the weight that you speak of?
Well, I think so, because at that point it would be purely a credibility determination. We don't have purely a credibility determination. There's no impeaching of Dr. Rowe's qualifications or her testimony. The government stipulated to the absolute lack of physical evidence at the supposed site of this murder. It is undisputed that there are contradictions in where this murder took place, whether it's in the basement or the bathtub, or in fact, who shot Melby, if either way, or who shot him at all. And I'm certainly not conceding that. So I do believe it is different than the situation you pose.
Counsel, isn't it true that the majority of the witnesses agree to the general circumstances of the murder, except some minor differences?
I wouldn't say they're minor differences.
No. Let's get the first point. Don't the majority of the witnesses agree to the killing?
If you're saying that either Booth admitted to killing Melby or expressed some desire to kill him if he found out he was an informant, yes, with the exception certainly of Susie Wilson. Unless the court has any other questions, I reserve my time.
Thank you, Mr. Berman. Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tim O'Shea for the United States. Before I get into the argument, I wanted to clear up a couple of factual points. Mr. Melby's remains were not buried by Mr. Booth, and we've not suggested so. Rather, as Mr. Simmonsmeyer's letter notes, that the body parts were simply dumped. They were perhaps in the process of being buried when Mr. Melby's arm fell out of a plastic bag.
And a tractor almost ran over it or something.
As I understand it, the backhoe was lifting up one pile of garbage and moving it into another spot, and then the arm fell out. And
the arm with a tattoo on it.
Yeah, with the tiger tattoo. And that's how they identified Mr. Melby's remains. And as Mr. Berman points out, they also found one of Mr. Melby's legs in a bag in proximity, or perhaps the same bag, and there was no bullet wound in the kneecap.
I didn't mean an Arlington Cemetery burial with full colors.
Right, either. Right. The second point is there is, as Mr. Berman pointed out, zero forensic evidence relating to the search of the Iron Wings clubhouse. They went into that search warrant soon after Mr. Melby's remains were recovered. They had zero suspects. They didn't know anything about the basement. They didn't do, as far as the record shows, any forensic testing down in the basement. I should note that it was a dirt floor down in the basement. At some point between when Mr. Melby was killed, remains were found, and today, the Iron Wings arranged to have a concrete floor poured down in the basement. So whatever dirt was somewhat considerably more inaccessible now. The district court is not clearly erroneous for two reasons. It's just been brought up. The district court had the opportunity to see these witnesses testify, to listen to them, and scrutinize their testimony on direct and cross-examination. And that's, you know, whether witnesses are telling the truth or not, that's the province of the district court. The second point, the second reason, category of reasons, I guess, that the district court was not clearly erroneous is that the defense must show that the district court's decision was without foundation. So let's look at the foundation, because that foundation, the factual foundation, shows that Mr. Booth did kill Mr. Melby. The witnesses were consistent, corroborated each other in the fact that Mr. Booth was, in fact, distributing drugs there at the clubhouse.
Do you agree that the evidence here would have been insufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I really don't. When we get the tape...
The state prosecution would have been commenced here if the state prosecutor thought they could convince the jury beyond a reasonable doubt that he had committed a murder.
Right. This came together, Your Honor, in connection with the federal prosecution of Mr. Booth. If you look at the timeline of things, the officers first executed the federal search warrant looking for guns and so on in the Booth Iron Wings clubhouse, and then started contacting most of these witnesses, Mr. Simmonsmeyer in particular. So it was really, perhaps theoretically it could have happened, but the investigation of the murder really developed in connection with the federal prosecution, Your Honor. The big thing is these guys got older. I mean, it was one thing when they were a bunch of 25-year-olds riding around acting like tough guys in northern Wisconsin, but this is with Mr. Simmonsmeyer, it weighed on his conscience. Now he had kids of his own, he was older, and he needed to get it off his chest, and he did. And whether or not Mr. Booth would have been convicted beyond a reasonable doubt, that tape, and that is probably the strongest reason why the district court's decision had a foundation. And at page 32 of my brief, I have some of the really salient points of that, where Mr. Simmonsmeyer is asking Roger Fatcat Wade, the gentleman who helped dispose of the body, why couldn't you guys have just buried him? And he says, I don't need this Fatcat. And Mr. Wade says, you know, he doesn't need it either, but that neither he or Mr. Booth are talking. That tape shows in several spots that Mr. Waite knows that the information about Melby's murder has been shared with Mr. Simmonsmeyer, and it also shows that Waite and Booth disposed of Melby's remains.
Mr. O'Shea, to Mr. Berman's point about whether we should look at standard.
Yeah.
And keeping in mind Judge Evans' inquiry about whether or not this would have carried the day in a state court prosecution, I'm not quarreling with a bootstrapping, if you will, of a significant sentence in a drug case where there's prior conduct. But take even the tape. The tape occurs maybe 11 years after the event.
Yeah.
Now, I know there's no statute of limitations for murder in any jurisdictions I'm familiar with. But this situation does get somewhat complicated by its dating. I mean, we find state prosecutions for murder all the time that are significant in the years past the death of the victim. But it does get compounded here that we have some dated testimony in the sense of memories and the like, which would have occurred in a state prosecution also. But it does put a particular focus, it seems to me, on getting what in effect would be close to, if not a murder sentence, a manslaughter sentence in most jurisdictions, through this standard that can give you some pause, I guess, you know. Does it give you any that we're dealing with, as you say, older riders rather than young bucks?
Well, the young bucks wouldn't have talked.
I understand.
So let's talk. This court has held in cases analogous to this, like Masters, for instance, is somewhat analogous to this, murder where somebody's sentence gets way up. That maybe there's that case is out there, we haven't found it yet. I don't think this case is it. And the question then is whether the age of this evidence should cause a higher standard to apply. I respectfully submit, no, that is the type of the ability of a person to remember is the type of thing that's precisely, that's what cross-examination for. And Mr. Booth has a fine lawyer on appeal, but also he had a fine lawyer down at the district court level, too. And the defense attorney had the opportunity to develop that. And there were contradictions. That perhaps explains some of the contradictions of the witness's testimony. But as has been pointed out here, these witnesses corroborated each other on the main point. So I think just based upon the age, I don't think that's appropriate.
Well, I guess what I'm amusing, and maybe it's not a good fit, you know, quite often in federal jurisdiction you find civil rights violations brought significantly after state court events that either did or didn't result in a prosecution.
Right.
But then, of course, the burden is, you know, the government's got to go to...
Like beyond a reasonable doubt. Sometimes they're really, really old, yeah.
Right, or you can have a hand-off prosecution on a gun charge, you know, because of a more significant sentence. But this does present us for want of a better term, sort of a mini-trial of a murder, right?
Absolutely.
The sentencing procedure.
Yep.
And resulting, as Mr. Berman and we all recognize, in a significant bump-up in a sentence. And it isn't based on... you know, four priors and the kind of bump up we normally get. So what would you say is most analogous if in your research to this kind of a bump up off of this kind of a record, and recognizing there is no identical case? Or did you not come across one?
Well, I've not found any case that applied to in a murder cross reference in a drug a higher standard, the clear and convincing. They all had applied the preponderance. I'm not trying to dodge
I'm trying to engage in the dialogue that
right.
Mr. Berman suggested we have. The kind of statements you sometimes find in appellate language, death is different.
Right.
And whether or not the line drawing, it could be a death case as opposed to, the underlying fact pattern for an enhancement.
I think the question, the court, when looking at this, perhaps it's like a clear error plus. I mean, the question then is whether the district court carefully scrutinized the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And here, clearly, the district court did. The district court heard all the evidence, and it said, you guys have to come back tomorrow. I've got to think about this. I've got to make findings on the record. And the district court then made very detailed, very explicit findings. It's clear that the district court had carefully scrutinized the evidence here. I'm sure she counted for the age of the testimony. And then she had written findings as well. It's clear that the district court did carefully scrutinize it. And I think this gets to, in terms of the burden, this gets to something that is kind of brought up in the Rodriguez case and then brought up by Judge Evans today. I mean, at what point does the clear error kick in? In Rodriguez, it was a marijuana case. So, you know, up to how many pounds of marijuana do we get preponderance? And after that point, do we start to go with clear error? And I respectfully submit that it's consistent and fair in the context of the guidelines to apply the preponderance. And I've been back and forth, and I'll probably be back again on a case called Noble. And Mr. Noble got the exact same sentence, 30 years. In that the district court made incremental, what I would call little sentencing determinations, as opposed to the one big one here, to arrive at that. There was a certain amount of cocaine that the district court found, a certain amount of marijuana. There was a gun in the closet that was his. He participated in criminal activity involving five or more participants. And based on those little factors, he got a 30-year sentence cumulatively. Well, here it's just one big factor. Why apply a different standard? And I to the degree we're talking about change at all, I think it's time to repudiate the Kikumira analysis and say, look, you know, for better or worse, we're going to go with the preponderance here. What we care about, what we're going to look at, is whether or not the district court carefully considered these sentencing factors.
Okay.
That's, I could talk about the other stuff involved here, but I was just asked that the court affirm, and I appreciate your time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. Ms. Berman?
Well, I suggest that the point has come in a case such as this where a higher standard ought to be applied. The maximum sentences in this case essentially became the mandatory minimum, just like the Martinez case, the opinion written by Judge Gertner that I referred to in my brief. I'd also indicate that Mr. O'Shea referred to the Masters case. In the Masters case, Judge Easterbrook indicated that the Sentencing Reform Act nor the guidelines specifies the burden of persuasion, so the courts must devise their own, and we're free to modify the standard as wisdom gained from experience suggests. I suggest that using the same standard that one would use before a court commissioner in a small claims trial, when some 20 years is at stake, when the maximum sentence becomes the mandatory minimum, is not sufficient. The government also indicated that there was no forensic testing, I believe was the phrase. That's not quite an accurate statement of the record. There was a meticulous search done of the Iron Wings clubhouse, and in fact, two knives were taken. One, I believe, from the car in which Melby was last seen, one from the clubhouse. Those were submitted to a crime laboratory in Minnesota. Again, absolutely zero indication of any blood. Also, zero indication of any blood in this house, where supposedly Melby is dragged from the basement up to a bathtub where he is dismembered. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Berman, the court wants to extend an additional special thanks for your accepting this appointment and so ably representing the petitioner.